All right. Well, welcome to Sheep Stuff You Should Know. It's late April, and I'm Dan Makin, UC Cooperative Extension and Flying Mule Sheep Company up here in the Sierra Foothills. And this week I'm joined by Ryan Mahoney, Amy Livestock down there in sunny Rio Vista. And good morning. How's things going?
Good morning, sir. How are you today?
I am good. How about you?
Oh, I'm great. You know, we had that big giant rainstorm that was supposed to come through, and I was all prepared. I was ready to shut myself in my closet and hide from the torrential downpour, and that darn bugger just skipped right over the top of us.
Did you guys get any rain at all?
No. We got a little dusting south of us and a little dusting north of us, and absolutely zero in Rio Vista. It was just nothing. It didn't even really get the concrete wet.
We had, I was gone, but Sammy said we had 1/18 of an inch here in Auburn, which...
Well, don't tell nobody. The politics will go up there getting after your water.
Oh, that's already happened.
I know. That's already happened. Say you have water in California, man. People come running.
Our irrigation district has a board meeting this morning that I'm not at, and they are talking about skipping over stage one drought and going right to stage two drought this year. So,
oh man, how does that affect the allocations?
You know, it probably won't affect our district provides both raw water and treated water, and mm-hmm. it won't affect allocations. It may affect our pricing.
Yeah.
They go into what they call conservation pricing. And so our expensive water gets a little more expensive.
Yeah. I think I get really frustrated when I read news articles about the water wars in California, because in order to do a good job describing the water systems in California, you really need to spend like a 3-day retreat, yeah, really delving into the specifics, because there's so many different types, yeah, of rights, the ways rights work. There's people that get water in drought, people that don't get water in drought, junior rights versus senior rights, yeah, groundwater. There's all these different layers, and so it's a very interesting, I mean, that's a fascinating topic in itself, but yeah, it's definitely not, it affects everybody, but it affects everybody differently.
You know, I'm going to give a little plug for a colleague that does a water podcast called Water Talk through Co-op Extension. And it's really good, kind of exploring all those nuances and complications, and yeah, it's worth checking out. So,
yeah, so
you, on your Instagram account yesterday, posted a really interesting photograph. And I know this is not a visual media that we're working in, but describe the photo that you posted and tell people where they could go look at it.
Well, I took a picture of the rainforest and I spliced it in half with a picture of Mars. And that's
that's kind of what it looks like.
About what it is. So we got a ranch, and I was talking to somebody yesterday, and I was going through my old photos from last year just to kind of try to get a comparison, and I found a good one, and it happened to be from the same day yesterday. So I drive right to the same spot, and I took a picture from the same spot, and then I, you know, put the two pictures together to show what the drought really is this year and how severe it is. And I mean, I don't know, it's so difficult to explain to people. And it's really pretty, if you live in drought country, you know what it's like, but, you know, drought affects every area differently.
Yeah.
And, you know, your stocking rates and densities are all tied to your normal rainfalls. And even Kurt was talking about how, you know, you take a 10-year average and your feed volume growth is usually fairly constant. Well, this is one of those situations where it's drastically down in our area. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, it's severe in our area. The field, so the picture we took was April 27th, 2020, and there was, I don't know, foot to 2 feet of green grass, and everything was green and healthy, mm-hmm. and still growing. There's a ton of ryegrass is the main feed for our hills for cattle, and so it grows in the mid to late spring. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the picture was a nice deal. Last year wasn't a good year. It was still dry. One of the problems with this year is we had no soil moisture going into the year. So
right.
It's pretty bad. And then this year, it's the same exact spot and everything is completely dead and dried out. And I mean, there's maybe 3 inches of feed on it, if that. And yeah. It's all, and the scary thing is that field last summer was composted and then planted. So oh, wow. It's not like a, I don't know. It's a, if anything, this year's photo should be better and healthier, you know, cause the soil health is much, you know, it's a richer soil and it has that compost, which should hold moisture better, which should get you more growth. And when you compare it to other fields, we have that happened. But, and so that picture is one of our better fields that we're hoping to use for some summer feed. And it's just, there's nothing there. It's just absolutely unbelievable how dry it is. And I know we're looking at, we've already destocked about 20% and we're probably going to lop off another. We're probably not going to sell these next ones. We'll just move them to our irrigated pasture, which we'd never do.
Yeah.
Because it's very expensive to run irrigated pasture, but this year it's going to be cheaper than buying hay. So we're going to end up probably destocking our dry land pastures probably by about 50% by the time we're done. And we may even go more than that depending on what happens.
You know, I think that's one of the real nuances of drought in annual rangeland like we run in, that it's hard to explain even to somebody that's running cattle in the plains or the Rocky Mountain states. Drought's really different here. And, you know, you think of the nutritional quality of that feed last year on April 27th, even if you had the volume this year, if it's dried out, you don't have the protein or energy in it. And so it's a difficult prospect, even in that aspect of it. We're going to be, this is the driest end of April since I've lived in Auburn in 20 years, drier even than 2014.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I know 76, I think, was the real bad one in our region. And most of the guys that were around then are saying this is the same, if not worse, than 76.
I was, I was 9 years old.
Yeah, I wasn't, my parents didn't even know each other in 76.
So. Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
They met in 78, I think.
I think I've mentioned this before. I did a survey of about 50 cattle and sheep producers about the last drought. And everybody that had ranched through 76, 77 said that was the worst drought in their generation. And I've talked to people subsequently that I talked to then that said this is worse.
So, yeah. But it's weird too, because it, like, you know, on our area, I know we have a lot of grasslands and so we're pretty densely stocked, but it just, and then you go and you look at like a Carrizo Plains ranch or one of those Bakersfield Hills ranches that kind of thrive on lower rainfall.
Yep.
And they're spread out a lot more. And so it affects them the same, but it takes our production and changes it to the production of one of those kind of places, I think.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So you got to change your stocking ratio to really match that. And that's the hardest thing, because you have breeding stock that, you know, breeding stock's a long-term investment. It's not a short-term investment. It's a multiple year payback. And so then trying to figure out how to destock, but not destroy what you built. And I don't know, I was talking to one guy and then you have your market hold situation, which we may get into.
Yeah.
But I was talking to one guy and I said, gosh, you know, this is a heck of a good year to sell just everything. Sell all your ewes, sell all your lambs at the high price, and then this fall just buy some bred ewes in. Let it go. But yeah, it's a crazy year. It sure as heck is. It's a challenge.
Let me ask you this, maybe go down this rabbit hole a little ways. How many calves do you need to get out of a heifer to recover your investment in that heifer?
Three.
How many sets of lambs do you need to get out of a ewe to recover your investment in that?
How many lambings?
Yep.
The current ewe price is one.
Okay.
Maybe two.
Okay.
One.
Okay.
So, and the economics on that would be like, so it's on a heifer. It cost us like $1,600 to raise a heifer. Mm-hmm. We raise an expensive heifer. I recognize that. But you can do it cheaper depending on what you're doing. But on our case, we're $1,600. And then it's about $600 a year to run a cow.
Okay.
And so you take that $600 a year plus the $1,600 input cost. You know, so it's $1,600 to get the first calf and then $600 a year to get a calf after that. You sell the calf for $1,100. It takes you 3 years to get ahead, mm-hmm. basically.
Yep.
On the ewe, I don't know. We sold some pretty good running age open ewes, ready to breed. And we got $182 for those. And In the same sale, you sold lambs for $300 a head. So you could buy those, breed them, put $100 into them. Your input costs $280. Sell the lambs for $300 and you're done.
And you're done.
So I mean, this is a weird market, but, so on more of an average market, when you're selling that lamb for say $150, $200, depending on if you're taking it fat or not, you'd probably be sitting there, about a 2 year
to
get that money back out of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a difference of approach if you look at it to hold, or if you're going to sell the coal. So you can sell a coal for $100 a head, $120 a head. So you got to add that back in.
Right. Right. It's kind of figuring the net present value of what those ewes are worth versus what those heifers are worth.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the bad part on the cattle deals. The local market's so flooded right now that it's just, there's not a lot of value and everything's going to the butcher market. And there's just not a lot of value in breeding stock. And our ewes are a good example of that. I mean, when you look at it on paper, that asset is worth, you can easily justify $350. When you figure, $400 in lamb sales / $50 in wool or $40 in wool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of income for that animal unit.
Well, and I think the cattle market's one of the primary differences between drought in 2013, 2014.
Yeah.
At that point, cows were worth a heck of a lot of money because
Texas was coming out of drought. And exactly. So they were looking for cows and they was just, it was great.
Well, yeah. if it makes you feel any better, I was in southern New Mexico last week and they've had less than a tenth of an inch of rain since October. So
maybe that's a drought. Maybe.
It was a little dry.
It was a little dry.
So we started talking a little bit about markets, and I wanted to maybe spend some time, the rest of our time this morning. It's been a year since we had the big COVID-related market, I guess you could call it adjustment. I'd call it a crash, maybe. And we're a year out of that now, and it seems like things are a little different this year, but I haven't sold anything for 6 months. I'm kind of curious as to what your read on the lamb market and on the call you market is and why we are where we are today. Where are we standing?
Yeah. Basically it's the Wild West right now. The market since COVID has been just absolutely messed up. I don't know how to call it. COVID, we're going to look back at COVID and it's going to be one of those great, how do you say it? I think the catchphrase nowadays is like, gosh dang it, I can't think of it.
Like an inflection point.
Before
COVID, after COVID.
You read a business book, they talk about the disruptor. Disruptor. That's what it is. COVID is a disruptor. But, yeah, I mean, COVID is the COVID incident has fundamentally changed so many things, and we are. I mean, I heard this before, but I'm starting to realize how this is going to last 4 or 5 years of disruption or things that are messed up or volatile. I guess the easiest way to say it is volatility, right? Yeah. Big swings up and down, and you're going to see that across the board, and most of it is related in a supply issue. Mm-hmm. The international trade just got messed up. It's like that boat getting stuck in the Suez Canal has implications for multiple months just because it put everything off track. Well, COVID put everything off track way worse than that boat did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's going to be really interesting to look back and see how, you know, you take that supply stuff and then you combine it with a fundamental shift in consumer demand and how people acquire foods. And I mean, it's going to be an interesting deal. So
tell me a little bit more about how volatility impacts your business model. I mean, what does that mean in terms of your planning process, short term and long term?
Yeah. So for us, the more volatile a market is, and the higher the market that's volatile gets, the less risk we want to take.
Okay.
So right now in the sheep market, it's extremely high, probably record highs. Feeders and fats. And so with that, I have very little risk appetite.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I buy, I'm trying to contract as soon as possible, and I want nothing open, so to say. I want to trade everything through a locked-in contract at a fixed small margin rather than try to, you know, score a big one.
To play that, yeah, right.
Now, the exact opposite position of being completely open is the one we're taking in feeder cattle. And that's because the market is low and is bouncing along its bottom end resistance. And it has been for a solid year and a half. And so those are two markets. They're different markets, but they're very similar. But we have completely different positions in both of them because, you know, the lamb market is, you know, use the easy term, lamb market's really good right now. So we don't want to be a part of it. we want to lock everything in. Cattle market is poor right now. So we're willing to take that risk because it's that downside potential isn't the same as in the lamb. It's a long fall from $2 a pound down to 85 cents than it is from $1.30 to $1.10.
Right.
Which is right. Kind of what, you know, those are the ranges in the sheep and cattle. So
in
from a risk position, that's probably the biggest fundamental thing.
What are the differences in your experience between the cattle market and the lamb market? Why are we where we are today in both markets, in your estimation?
Yeah, I think we can run into a lot of risk or a lot of problems getting too obsessed with comparing protein markets,
mm-hmm.
especially being in the sheep. I think you can compare. I guess to compare them to try to see what's going on in the one, and say that what's happening in one is going to be what happens in the other, I think that's false.
I do too.
Analyze one and see what moved it and then look for similar signs in another one is a proper way to kind of digest that data. And really what that's sourced in is like, you know, you have the lamb situation, but the impact of MSR's bankruptcy is huge. And it just happened to happen when COVID hit.
Right.
And if we didn't have COVID and the MSR bankruptcy happened, we would still have a huge event, market event, that created volatility in the sheep market.
Right.
It may have not been as dramatic, but it certainly would have affected everybody to a degree. And so, you know, these markets are very dynamic and they're very complex. And no matter how good of a market analysis you are, you're almost always reacting and saying why something happened rather than being able to predict what's going to happen. Because if it's easy to predict, everybody knows it and are going to jump it and change it.
Yeah, so, right.
Yeah.
Is part of this lamb market issue, you talked about supply, but is part of it kind of a realignment of our end market from food service to something different?
Yeah. And that kind of gets back to that. What I was trying to allude at is that the land market is moving for a multitude of reasons. It's not one thing. It's right. a multitude of things. At the base, you know, all economics are based on supply and demand for the most part, until you have government interference. And I actually have a question for you about government buys. It struck me here, but, anyway, you have the COVID situation that realigned the consumer. So the consumer stopped buying at restaurants and started only buying at the grocery stores. We had the grocery stores then run out of proteins, which forced people to buy lamb that never bought lamb before, which then created new customer demand. So new customers wanted to go back to buy lamb every single time. You had an increase in all protein prices. A lot of that margin, a lot of people blame the packer. Packer margins, if you were set up for retail, were good, but the efficiencies of packers were so blown to heck, and the labor situation is nothing to joke about.
Yeah.
Your profitability was good in some of them, but not good across the board. Now retailers crushed it this last year. They were able to mark up, 100-200% margins on their retail product because consumers weren't looking at price. They just wanted protein on their plates.
Yeah.
And, don't just blame that next guy up on that production chain. Try to, look at all of it.
Look at the whole thing. Yeah.
Pull that margin back to your leverage if you can. So you had that. You also have this, you had the MSR bankruptcy. So you had the shutdown of a plant that created a short-term oversupply, but then you had moves by that company that basically overpredicted the undersupply. So people thought there was going to be more lambs around than actually were, which turned the market quickly. Then you had the opening of the brush plant, the opening of the San Angelo plant. So then you had opening of two new plants, and which has created more demand on that supply. So you had this sharp crash and then this skyrocketing price that you're seeing now. And, right now today there's a shortage of lambs, and it's a shortage for the summer supply. And, there's more demand than we can supply as an industry, but there's also a cap. Oh, and then the other big factor too, is the whole international trade and the dependent, being able to depend on traffic coming through the ocean into the U.S. Mm-hmm. That's your import market. So you struggle to get imports in, plus you have this huge boom, and it's just, it's kind of the perfect storm for crashing and going up. it's just crazy. I mean, this time last year, we were selling lambs for, 65, 70 cents a pound fat, was some of the lower ones I've heard. And here we are today, and the latest market report is like 65 up to $2 or something like that in the AMS data. So it's crazy the swing that we've seen. And it's because of all reasons, but it's basically because everything got messed up and it's
right.
kind of broken.
It's
all getting retooled and retooled very fast. So
as Dan Makin, small scale sheep producer here in the Sierra foothills, gosh, my feeder lambs, when I sell them in a month and a half, are going to be worth more than they were last year, probably.
Yeah, I'll buy them today for more money than you ever got. Yeah.
But on the other hand, that's a really short-term focus for Dan Makin, right? That's this year getting better from last year.
So, yeah, probably. And actually, break that down to, it's something to be very excited about. We haven't had... they talk about leverage in that production line and the trade. The U has not had leverage in the sheep industry for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they have leverage this year that they've never had before. And that's good place to be.
What does that mean? Tell me.
Leverage. So price discovery is influenced by consumer demand for the short supply. So when you have no supply, you have the leverage to set the price.
Okay.
It's always a price discovery between people, and people are fighting for their margins.
So the U has the leverage right now.
Yeah. The U has the leverage because there's no sheep. Yeah. Typically the consumer or the retailer or the packer has the leverage because the consumer demand. It's not that they're controlling the market. It's that consumer demand isn't allowing them to pay more. So
it's the driver. It's the driver.
Yeah. And right now it's the other way around. Like I said, I mean, when people were flat out running out of protein, I mean, that's unbelievable. And you have beef. Beef is darn near the same price as lamb in these stores now too. So it's not as scary of a price point to get into. And you have the government passing out a ton of money, which has created a lot of, you know, just spendable cash that guys are wanting to spend money on. And people have been so cooped up for so long that you see it a lot of places. They're wanting to get out or have experiences. So they're putting more money into the dinner table plates. You know, they're willing to spend a little extra to make that time special because, you know, they lacked that for so long. And so so the consumer demand for cheap meat isn't quite the same as it was, you know, a year ago.
I diverted you away from my original question, though. Is this good market a win over the long term for a producer? What are the potential downsides for us?
Yeah, no. So I think it's a win for Dan Macon, right? For this year, it's a win for all you producers this year.
Yep.
But we need stable infrastructure in our industry all the way through. And this puts a lot of pressure on all of that infrastructure up. So you have this market turn, the beef market, you look in 13, 14, whenever that was, the beef market was absolutely through the roof. All of a sudden they turned oversupply and you had ranches getting foreclosed on by the banks because they didn't pay attention to their risk profile and they borrowed too much money based on the high artificial bubble values rather than the actual, you know, expense equation value. You know, they got reckless, so to say, because it was so good that they ended up going out of business. So with volatility comes stress on those operators. And I don't want anybody to go broke in the sheep industry because there's nobody left. I want to hold it together. So we really need, you know, when markets get really good, you got to get really disciplined, I think, and just pay attention to these worst case scenarios because, you know, when you do a worst case scenario at a dollar fatland market, the downside risk is pretty minimal. I mean, you might drop to 85 cents, you might drop to 70 cents, but, you know, it's not like the downside risk of a $2 market.
Right.
You know, I mean, you're talking on, I don't know what it is, on 5,000 head times 150 pounds fat, that's 75, no. It should be 750,000 pounds. 5,000 head times 150 pounds is 750,000. That's $1 million value swing. A dollar a pound would be $750,000 value swing. So on a $2 market, your 5,000 lambs are worth $1.5 million. On a $1 market, they're worth $750,000. So if you go and borrow $760,000, which is cheap and reasonable on this high market, all of a sudden, you're toast when the market goes to buck. You can't make it.
You're hanging way, way out there.
Yeah. And so you really gotta worry about the downside risk when you get in these high markets. That doesn't mean don't take advantage of them.
Right. But don't base long-term decisions on where.
Yeah, don't expect. I guess the biggest thing is take advantage of these high markets. Don't expect them to stay around forever.
Right.
It's probably the best way to say it.
Right.
Now, all that said, who knows what's going to happen because there's so much cash injected into the economy. There's so much demand for the product and there's so much kind of inflation isn't the correct word right now, but inflating prices of things that it's going to be very interesting to see where the price stabilizes at over the next 3, 4, 5 years. But who knows?
One of the questions I have over that next 3 to 5 years is, has the profile of our market for lamb changed substantially to reflect a little different market situation going forward? Is less dependence on food service going to stabilize our market, or is it going to continue to be volatile?
I think the answer is you got potential for both. This is all opinion. But I think you have potential for both. But you can't stabilize the retail supply, the retailer, unless you can stabilize supply somewhat. And so right. you got to,
right.
You know, we have a huge supply issue. Colorado lambs on feed inventory is down 20% wow. year over year. And it's 20% off of last year and 20% off the, I think a little more than 20%, like 22% off the 5-year average. So, and you know, in lamb terms, that's 25,000 lambs, but in percentage terms, that's a huge percentage of your industry that's down. And then yep. you have your kill capacity isn't really down much, you know, with the new plants opening up. So it's just, it's a big stressor on the industry, just this yeah. supply tightness.
Yeah, right, right. So. And what then happens when people can't get lamb at the retailer or,
and know. Vice versa, when that retailer can't get lamb from an American producer,
yep.
and they go to the import and they find stability in the supply, do they stay with it?
Right.
And that's the big risk we have as the industry. The American brand carries value because it's worth it. But you can only, if you short, you know, if you guarantee Costco, you know, 1,000 lambs a week and you give them 700, they're 700 Costco's leaving.
Yeah, they're going to fill that hole.
They're pretty darn efficient company and they pay attention to that stuff. And, you know, they do recognize the value and but it's just, yeah.
Well, we've talked about wool recently, but I want to maybe transition to the wool market because it's an interesting illustration of kind of market, not fragmentation, but segmentation, I guess, too. Where's fine wool like you guys are selling now?
I haven't looked since April 1st, but April 1st, we were sitting right around $3 a pound. Well, no, $2.60, I think, on the international market.
Okay.
In the U.S., the market's down from that. Typically, we trade at about 80%. Of the international market. So whatever 80% of 260, 270 is.
Yeah.
Is about where we're probably trading at. But yeah, it's just there's not a lot of movement. There's some and there's getting to be some life. Your crossbred lamb's wool is sitting in the shed still, not getting bids. There's a big sale coming up here in I think tomorrow or the next day in Roswell. And so hopefully we'll see some bids down there. But there's just not a lot of active guys yet. Yeah. And so it's still kind of just working its way out. Wool has to start moving eventually. It's too good of a product and it doesn't spoil. And so eventually it's going to start moving more. I know we sold most of our last year's inventory. We sold it cheap for like $1 a pound, but, that was a dollar that I got.
Yeah. So, right.
You know, just close the book and move on. Your first loss is your cheapest loss. Usually, so.
Yeah. 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 I'm not sure we're going to shear Saturday actually. And I'm not sure what will happen with our wool. I don't know that I've got space to store it for very long, but that may be what we end up doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, wool's not worth our 2019 wool is still hanging out in a warehouse.
Yeah. Well, we got a shed that we store the wool in. You can always throw a bag in there if you want.
So. You've got room for a couple bags?
That's just sitting there, yeah. We're a drop. So we're a collection point for Roswell.
Oh, okay.
We'll get a bunch of guys will bring stuff and we'll source the loads there. But.
We've worked with them up until 2 years ago to do some wool pulling up here, just small people combining stuff, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's just there's no market, and so it's pretty tough. Yeah, yeah. Especially those strong wools.
Yeah, yep, exactly.
Yeah, I still think. I mean, I think, you know, I think the industry is going to hear a lot of push from the packers, anybody on that side to increase lamb meat production. But I do think, as sheep producers, we really need to look at working on our wool production. I still think that's the easiest way to improve our on farm value.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to discount the fact that you should improve your meat production, but you know, that sheep is a dual purpose animal and I'm glad you brought the wool market up because it's important to not lose sight of that. So,
yeah, I think it's maybe a small piece for a lot of folks, but it is a piece. And I think, like you say, it's an area we can really focus some improvement on.
Yeah, and I think over time you can increase that piece. You know, you can increase that amount if by paying attention. I mean, we talked about it a bunch.
But yeah,
I think you can. I think you can work on that.
So. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I did. I did pull up some charts just because I was curious. But the so, oh, and I got to ask you my question on government buys. But
yeah,
so the square cut shoulder is up from 325 last year to like 360 this year.
Okay.
So that's up in value.
10% or so.
Yeah. The eight rib rack is down, I don't know, $5-$10 from last year.
Is that a retail versus restaurant issue, you think?
I think possibly. So the eight rib is down. The trimmed 4x4 loin is up huge. It's up from 530 up to 690.
Wow.
And so that's a retail cut, I think.
Yeah.
And then the weekly leg, so the leg price is up substantially too. It's up from like 380, 395 up to like, you know, 430. And so it's interesting how when you look at the types of racks like that, and that's a good illustration of how you have, you know, these square cut shoulders and these legs that are all up. And a lot of that is because the ability to get that into a retail package.
Yeah.
But then your traditional eight rib rack that has driven the US market for so long is down.
Doesn't have the value.
Yeah. You know, but to me, that's a healthy sign of an industry. I think it gets back to that, you know, we're only focusing on meat production on the lamb from the U side, while our packing production was only focused on the racks. We were just getting as much as we could for those racks rather than looking at that whole lamb. And to be able to see these huge increase in values in these, you know, the square cut shoulders and the legs, that's fantastic for the industry, because that means we're bringing more dollars to that whole lamb rather than trying to pull it all out of one part.
Well, and I think one of the remarkable and probably unappreciated stories of the last year was how quickly packers were able to reconfigure their processing lines to meet that shift in demand.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's simple to say, well, eight rib racks aren't moving now. Let's just retool and do something different. That's not easy. It's like turning that ship in the Suez Canal in some respects. You know, you got to shift the whole processing line, yeah, don't you?
Yeah. Corporations thrive on process and consistency, right? You got systems that things go through, and you maximize the efficiency of those systems. And to be able to just retool the whole thing for different is pretty impressive.
And yeah.
Yeah. I think that's, I mean, every packer that's processing lambs right now is a success, because COVID has not been easy on those guys. I talk about it. I don't think it can be emphasized enough how, like, when your chain speed drops 10% or 20%, it's like a 30, 40% hit to your efficiency equation. Kills you, the price, the add ups on that stuff. When you have a third of your workforce not show up because of COVID, I mean that that is a tough thing to work through. I mean those are people that you need to keep motivated, that need to be proud of their work, that keep, you know, I mean that's a tough job. And I mean all of these guys that are running these plants, I think they're really doing an amazing job to be able to still be standing at the end of this COVID thing. So
yeah, I do too. Yeah. I do too. I think that's a really good point.
So my other question for you was, we had, you know, the market crashed, this COVID hit, market crashed. We weren't getting anything for the lambs. And so then the traditional ways for government to support the industry is they go make these buys, right? They make these meat buys, put them out to bid to all the packers or, you know, anybody processing, and then they can bid on it, and then they award the bid basically to offload backed up inventory, and then they feed the troops shanks or that whatever the product is. So COVID hit in March. They did the government buys in April, May. I'm using number. I don't know exactly what it is, but in those first couple months after COVID kind of hit and blew everything up. And then you had the market, like right when they delivered, so they would have done the contracts April, May, delivered in May, June, somewhere in there. And then right when that happened, the market slowly began to turn and then just got to a point where, you know, 4 or 5 months later, we're completely out of racks. And I'm disappointed because I can't buy cheap racks anymore. But, you know, from a market perspective, is that on a small commodity like lamb, are large government buys helpful or hurtful to the industry?
Oh, man. Man, that's a tough question. That's probably above my pay grade, or certainly above my expertise.
I just want to get us in trouble with whoever. Yeah.
We already are. We already are.
Yeah, no, but I've been thinking about that though, and as the volume or the supply has shrunk in the lamb industry, those government buys have huge impact on the price and things. And there's times where, you know, product gets backed up in those freezers and it does need to move, but I don't know. I
think that's a interesting question for lots of reasons. I think, you know, fundamentally being focused on free markets and kind of survival in the free market is part of who we are, at least between the years. But those kinds of buys have been going on a long time. And it'd be interesting to know what that has done to the volatility in our market. Does it stabilize the market or does it increase the volatility in our market?
Yeah. And I think the government buys are absolutely excellent tool. You know, we have an army that needs to be fed. We have food missions all around the world that need food and proteins, especially to get into, especially some of these third world countries. So I think the government buys are excellent, you know, to take that money that needs to go and buy some kind of commodity. It makes sense to buy the overstock to help, you know, support those markets. I'm curious, like if you have 3 containers go out of the pork complex into the government buy, nobody knows.
Right. Three containers of lamb.
Yeah. 3 containers of lamb. All of a sudden you've taken an oversupply and created a shortage overnight. And I mean, and it would be the same for some of these other small commodities in California, like asparagus would be, if you do a big asparagus buy, all of a sudden, boom.
Right. I think the other piece of that question for me is where do you focus that intervention? So we had 2 interventions at least last year, right? We had the lamb buys.
Yeah.
But then we had also these direct payments to producers.
Yeah.
Offset the market disruption from COVID. And where as an industry are those investments most successful in kind of stabilizing the industry? We may have to have Dr. Cytone on again to explore some of these questions too.
Yeah. I don't know something. I think I'm just thinking out loud, but I think if those government buys could be more targeted rather than say all racks, if it could be whole lamb products or something like that, might be a better way to support the smaller commodity market. Because when you buy all the racks out, you just end up with a shortage of racks and then too many legs. When you buy all the legs out, you end up with too many racks and not enough. It's such a small commodity when you, and I don't know, I'm treading in dangerous waters with as little as I know of these things, but it's fun to talk about. And it's been on my mind. I've been stewing it around for a bit.
So what you just said is related to something that, do you know the guys at Panorama Beef used to be? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of their founders told me, gosh, probably 15 years ago, that until the last package of ground beef is sold, you haven't actually made a profit selling that carcass. That you got to look at the whole animal. And I think that's a different equation with beef, just given the size and the variety of products. But I think that's true in lamb too.
Yeah.
That if you focus on one cut or one primal.
But then couldn't you make the argument that when you're backed up in say racks, the government does need to come in and buy those to offload and get that last piece sold?
You could say that. And I don't know that that's the right answer in the long term.
Yeah, I don't know neither. That's kind of why I like these kind of thought experiments, just kind of trying to vet out what, you know. Yeah. I think that's how we make better decisions is by, you know, taking something like that, being willing to talk about it.
I do too.
Admit you're wrong and go forward.
So, I do too. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, gosh, this is, as always, Ryan, I've learned a lot. And I think, you know, I think for a small operation like ours, sometimes it can feel like you're just kind of navigating in the dark. I don't know that we pay as much attention to those fundamentals as you do. And I think it's important at any scale to be paying attention to that.
Yeah, I think it's important to know what it's worth. But then I also think, you know, when you're raising a commodity, you need to recognize it's going to be a commodity. And at the end of the day, you're going to sell at market. So work right on your, you know, maximize that production.
Right.
You know, educate yourself so you know how to maximize that production. That comment about taking in all the way to the fat versus selling them as a feeder versus, you know, those all decisions all play into that. But at the end of the day, educate yourself, know that you're going to sell at the market. Don't put all of your stock into having a good market. Put it into having that, you know, what is it, that the tonnage, the pounds, you know, and then do it at a reasonable expense.
Well, I think a lot of times we focus on maximizing as opposed to optimizing. We look
That's a much better word.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the underlying economics of your own operation are the most important thing to pay attention to, I think.
Yeah.
You can't control the market necessarily, but you can sure control your production.
Yeah, and I mean, the smaller numbers you have, the less control of them. I mean, if you can get some pretty big numbers put together, you can influence that market a little bit. But, yeah. You know, when you're, especially if you're producing on a smaller headcount scale, you're not going to change that price. You can improve your dollars if you do direct sales, but, you know, figure out the costs. You can improve right your dollars by, you know, a lot of different ways, or maybe just sell them. Come on, you know, there's a lot of ways to do it. Just investigate those options, understand what the costs and implications of them are, and do what's best for you.
Well, and I think there is, while you can't influence the price, there is a range of prices within the commodity market. And if your product at a small scale is really high quality, that's mm-hmm. rewarded in the commodity market too.
And it gets back to genetics, it gets back to the ranch, mm-hmm. gets back to finish, gets back to location. I mean, all of those things influence your opportunities. And yep. so, and just because it's one year doesn't mean it's one every year. So,
right.
you know, a year right. like this, it makes sense to, you know, sell commodity because it's just too much money yep. for the work of supplying farmers markets. But then another year, you're raising sheep and you're figuring out how to raise sheep in downtown San Francisco, you sure as heck better sell them there. So, <Yeah. laughs> like it's just, I don't know, know kind of where you're at and what the opportunities are. So,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep. Well,
all right. Well, back at it, huh?
Yeah. So I guess this is, I appreciate the time, Dan. This is Sheep Stuff You Should Know. Had a great conversation today. That was fun. And look forward to next time. I don't get to see you for like 2 weeks now. So
that phone works. I'll call you.
Yeah. It gets lonely sometimes out here in the hills. So, all right, Dan, you take it easy.
Thanks, Ryan. Have a good
week.
See
you next time. Bye.
All right.